Welcome, everyone, to episode 246 of the Metabolist 2 podcast featuring myself, Ben.
And David. And
boom, have we got a show for you tonight.
Boom. Stephen Moffat's back.
He's back. He's back with a boom.
Boom. New companion actor debuts.
Boom. Robots. not
boom.
Robots.
Susan Twist is back.
Boom. Yeah, there's some things. Boom.
Ruby gets shot.
Boom. There's a dad lost in a machine, as so often happens. Yeah, enough with the booms.
Yeah, enough of boom time.
and there we have it. There you go. It's over.
Encapsulated. There you go.
Exactly. We really enjoyed this one. We thought it was great. It
carries on from The Empty Child and Blink. It's a return of Stephen Moffat under RTD, basically.
Absolutely. I think
Silence in the Library, you know, all of that.
It's all of those mixed together, really, in some ways. I think Stephen Moffat works well under RTD, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he responded that well to the pressure of being the showrunner and a writer. But that final Capaldi season was great. So, yeah, it was good to have Stephen back, and I think he did a good job. I mean, still felt it was going a little bit too quickly for my liking, but that's just my liking.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, in terms of how it was put together and the action, that was a pretty good episode of Doctor Who.
But you couldn't have Gatwa standing on a landmine for 45 minutes and dragging it out even longer. That's a long time. Even
well, that's true. That's true. That's true.
It's a two-parter where 90
He's
minutes
standing on a landmine. It creates tension. It's like a, movies where they're stuck in a, you know, it's one of those, what's
speeding bus movies type
yes,
things.
Yes, exactly.
You set the premise and every
exactly.
10 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever, you increase the tension.
It's like Die Hard, but on a landmine.
Boom hard.
Yep. Die landmine hard. Yeah, exactly. You set the rigid parameters and then set the plot going, see what happens, basically. I thought it was the first, again, reading around, it was the first time that they've used that kind of Mandalorian Baby Yoda style LED screen background thing as well, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Real-time digital backgrounds, which tracks with the camera,
yeah.
And I thought it was pretty amazing what they could do with it.
I mean, it still looks artificial, but it looks artificial in a different way. So I thought it worked really well, especially for, you know, a production where we're on a battlefield, there's smoke billowing around, there's flames, there's fire.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was excellent and worked really well. What I didn't think worked hugely well is the gearing between the base where all the vicars were hanging out and the battlefield itself. I think people moved a little bit quickly between battlefield and base. But, you know, that's just me.
It could be that was deliberate because they weren't really fighting anyone and they're just fighting their equipment, as was the point.
Well, that is true, yes.
They wouldn't have to go far to engage with landmines they spread out or their Susan Twist ambulance of doom.
Evil Susan Twist ambulances of doom. Very true. No, that's very true. Yep. Okay. I stand corrected. Yes.
I don't know.
That is a good in-universe explanation.
It also harkens back to battlefields a la Genesis of the Daleks, where we have Thals and Khalids basically across the football pitch from each other.
Yeah, you can leisurely stroll, avoiding, of course, the clams on the way between the two domes and mm-hmm. all is well. I like the return of the clerics. That's one of Moffat's things, the mm-hmm. soldiers of Vickers. I like the fact that they are Anglicans. Which I think is funny. It's a funny joke to have all the soldiers be basically Anglican vicars.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the anti-religion thing that Moffat likes.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the anti-capital thing that Moffat likes, a la Oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it hit very reminiscent of Oxygen.
Absolutely.
And Chibnall tried to do it, I think, two in one or two of his stories, but then you also have the kind of the other extreme where you have AI with Kerblam. So this seems to be the other side of the coin of Kerblam.
Yeah, and I, again, Kerblam just wasn't well thought through, in my opinion, and we all ended up going like, yeah, Amazon is great. We should all be working for them, which is really not Doctor Who at all. Doctor Who is always, Amazon is horrible. They're trying to take over the world. We need to destroy them in some kind of way. So, I think that was very well realized and kind of nice to see Doctor Who being all smash the system-y, which is, you know, what it should be, basically. It should be smashing the system. We should be smashing the system.
It does follow on themes or threads that Moffat has sewn throughout his career, both as writer and then showrunner with Villengard, because that was back in the Empty Child Doctor Dances where Captain Jack got his square gun. And
wow, you've done your research.
That was the thing that the Doctor blew up. Yeah, well, it was... Okay. Where the Doctor blew up, put in the banana grove, and then the weapon factory of Villengard. The reason why this kind of popped into my mind is because in Twice Upon a Time, where Rusty the Dalek was, that was the ruins of the Villengard weapon factory, and so that kind of bookend Moffat's tenure with the show. And now, do we have to have Villengard back every time Moffat returns because he wants to have it in the first and last thing he writes? I, you know, just throwing it out there.
Who knows? But yeah, well spotted. I'd not put that together, basically. So
yeah. And the resolution with AI is obviously very prevalent in the news or the stuff people are dealing with, but the holographic Verger dad, Francis or John Francis Vader, who splices dead dad.
Yeah. Return of the Living Dad.
The power of love once again. So dead it dad. Seems like that's a father's love, especially, is a theme that Moffat cultivates quite a bit.
Absolutely. Of course. Why not? We fathers need our place in the sun as well. Again, it's definitely a Moffat thing that if you are stuck inside an AI simulation, that's fine. If no one really dies, as long as you're downloaded in some kind of computer and everyone's happy with that. Which is Silence in the Library.
River Song
style. I'm not fully convinced by that. Maybe we will go into some kind of AI simulation and Splice's dad will be back in actual form rather than just in weird computer saving the day form. So I thought that didn't land hugely well for me because the kid's dad just got exploded by a landmine.
Right.
But, you know, fine. They are now an AI, not, you know, a kind of slightly glitchy AI instead. But, you know, that works. And it's very Moffat-y.
It's very Moffat-y, but for me, it doesn't have a lot of crunch. It feels hand-wavy to me that it's sort of like, well, we're just going to upload the virus or we're just going to send this AI agent in to go dig around for evidence. And then lo and behold, he gets pissed off and takes down the entire system. I like the story that like the original Tron movie told,
right,
where the characters are active within the system. So this would be like, more like even with the Deadly Assassin where the Doctor goes into the Matrix, into the computer itself. So I feel that has a lot more involvement. And this was kind of a rather quick resolution. And maybe that's where you're feeling cheated on running time.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I wasn't convinced that it was resolved.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the landmine thing was resolved. Yes, great. Like the Doctor is no longer going to explode and destroy half the planet. Cause, I mean, because he's, you know, a quantum entangled event or whatever the hell he is nowadays.
Upping the ante, always.
Upping the stakes, always. He's like, he's not even a Time Lord anymore. He's like, what am I? That was obviously resolved. Fine. Mm-hmm. I just didn't feel that the my dad is dead aspect was resolved entirely realistically.
No.
But, you know, there you go. That's fine.
Yeah, and I'm not a terribly religious person, and I don't think Davis and Moffat are either.
No.
And so I almost feel like they should have had a faith consultant on set or something to look over the script, because the upbraiding of Mundy and Faith was good. I thought that was spot on. That resonated very true. But then the girl Splice, and then the Doctor saying at the end, you have to maintain faith, that contradiction. Yeah, it's very much a contradiction. But Splice's reaction that, you know, she's carrying her, the corpse of her dad around in a in a tube, and Mundy Flynn's suitor or love interest, and she's carrying his corpse around, and it was just sort of like a cheery, oh, love conquers all ending, and it just, it seemed tonally off to me a little bit.
Yeah, it seemed definitely seemed tonally off to me. I didn't think they'd be that cheerful, especially since we'd already kind of established that the dead bodies in the tubes were kind of gross.
Smelted, I think is the word the doctor used.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just have ashes or something, like, you know, like a regular dead body. Don't go all kind of body horror on it and then backtrack and say, like, ah, he's still here, he's still alive in a computer. And also you've got his corpse, but it's all squished out. I was hoping, actually, that would be some kind of tissue compression eliminator device that we'd be talking about, but I guess that didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, it does certainly seem like that, but it's more grotesque even than tissue compression.
Exactly. It's worse than the Master.
Yeah.
Works. I mean, so. I'm fine if my dad was like a little kind of, you know, like an action figure.
Yeah. Okay.
But if he's like squashed into a weird cylinder, you can like see an eye poking out. No.
Yeah.
No,
a little too gross. Actually.
Yeah. A little too gross for the joy that everyone was feeling at the end.
Yes. It's horror, and it didn't seem to affect Splice or Mundy at all, really. Yeah. I mean, not the way I would have been freaked out entirely by it.
Right.
And I guess that's the guide I'm judging this by.
It is the only guide that we can judge things by, yeah. What else?
Susan Twist is back, and much more screen time than she had in the prior...
Yeah, I was...
All episodes, actually, with her in.
I was a little confused by this, because obviously Susan Twist... What am I saying? So every time we've seen Susan Twist up until now, she has manifested herself after our heroes have arrived on the scene.
Right.
So, and I can buy that she's some kind of, I don't know, splintered thing that's following them through time. But she apparently knew they were going to come to this planet beforehand because she manifested herself as one of these as the ambulance.
Right.
Presumably has been the ambulance for like the entire war and was invented by the evil company. So I mean, she's playing some kind of I know what's happening in the future kind of long game at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Am I wrong about that? I don't know.
I don't know, or if this is just she's just a kind of a coincidence of time. I do think her malevolence in this episode really pulls back on any kind of speculation that she was some kind of Susan Foreman echo.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I didn't think she was malevolent. She was just a computer that's doing its job. I'm programmed to, you know, assess the health of combatants and take the appropriate action as their programming demanded, which is if you can't get well in a certain amount of time, then we're going to have you terminated.
Right.
So, I mean, I didn't feel that she was bad. I just felt she was the face of a computer that was doing its job and was obviously presumably programmed into that computer as a face a long time ago.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know what kind of thing she is. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of certainly since last episode we were hearing about Susan and 1963,
right,
and you're a grandfather,
yep,
and then this episode we're hearing about, like, I'm a dad. There's definitely a doctor's family thing coming through here, whether that's just, you know, laying the groundwork for new viewers or whether there's going to be some kind of payoff at the end of these 8 episodes and it's return of Susan. I don't know, but definitely I don't think Twist has got anything to do with that at this point.
Right.
Or maybe, yeah. I don't know, maybe.
I think the clues went cold here with that, that line.
Right.
So it would make more sense if she was the East Ender woman, splintered through time.
Anita Dobson.
Yeah.
Angie from the old Vic, yeah.
If it was more of a conventional twist, it would be her neighbor, but it isn't. So I'm not sure how her neighbor fits in with Susan Twist, who fits in with the story at large, because she obviously had some recognition of the TARDIS.
Yeah, and I think the problem with the Susan Twist thing is we don't have a baseline Susan Twist, unless she's always been, you know, Sir Isaac Newton's maidservant, which I don't think she has been, which is the first time we saw her.
Right.
What is she? We need to have, like, where she is for her to kind of make sense in terms of a payoff of plot, I think. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not writing the thing, so I guess we'll find out. Unless it's some kind of thing that they don't resolve in a kind of Moffat sort of way, which I hope they're going to resolve it, because I think the whole Moffat non-resolving thing is irritating.
Well, I'm going to throw this out.
Throw away.
That maybe that we've had foreshadowed that there's a big bad. That somebody who the Beast referred to as the boss.
He who waits.
I'm wondering if Susan Twist is the overarching deity, or maybe the mom to Neil Patrick Harris's The Toymaker, father figure that Susan Twist is.
Right.
I don't know. What would be anything other than, I mean, we have grandfather time, so is this grandmother time type thing?
I don't know, grandfather paradox. I don't know. You know, there's an arms race for, I mean, I really felt this strongly with Flux. It's like, you know, okay, how often has the universe got to be destroyed before it gets boring?
Right. It's already boring.
It's already boring. I mean, how many pile upon pile upon pile of kind of omnipresent beings can we have that are then easily defeated by the Beatles doing a quick chord on the piano? Can we actually stack right. up here for them to be a credible threat? I mean, I guess Twist, if they are a threat, and I'm just calling a Twist because that's the actor, apparently that's the actor's name. Mm-hmm. She's apparently a threat of some kind. She's not being very threatening yet, apart from just existing. And I would like to see her be more obviously something that is threatening to the Doctor and to Ruby, rather than someone who just turns up every episode as a different character, which is not very threatening at all. Really.
Another bad wolf.
And I mean, bad wolf is threatening because it's mm-hmm. bad and it's a wolf. So it's a wolf, which is a bad thing, and right. it's a bad wolf. Mm-hmm. So it's like twice as bad as a regular wolf. So that's already threatening. But like a woman who's mm-hmm. sometimes is on a screen and sometimes is a hippie in a bar and sometimes is a maidservant in the 1600s. That's not threatening at all. It's just a thing. Mm-hmm. So up the threat level, lads.
Maybe in 73 yards, we'll see that she's a poltergeist of some sort or
spooky.
Something.
Spooky, yeah. So again, what I would have done, I think, is I would have had Twist be one of the clerics. That would have worked for me. To have her be the...
Bishop.
Yeah, a bishop. Have her be a bishop. Yeah. You can have lady bishops nowadays. It's perfectly acceptable. Mm-hmm. Rather than be like the, you know, the antagonist of the whole show, the evil ambulances, I would have had her to walk on part as a bishop, all dressed in purple, with a special kind of hat.
mitre.
Exactly. A bishop, a military mitre. That's what I would have done. But again, you know, it's literally not up to me. So we will see. What did you think about the Doctor's, which I've seen some criticisms of this, but I guess I don't mind it. They're kind of establishing a character. The Doctor's willingness to cry at the drop of a hat. I mean, I guess he was standing on a landmine, so that's going to make me cry, but then he's the Doctor, so I don't know about that.
Well, he standing on the landmine was going through a lot of emotions, trying to regulate himself, trying to focus.
Singing the Sky Boat song.
Yeah, call back to Tron.
Exactly.
I think it's fine. I think he wears his emotions very close to the surface, and I like seeing this version of the Doctor full of joy, full of pain, full of life, and he wears it very openly. I think that's fine.
Yeah, I'm possibly in finding him at this point a little too cheerful all the time, which I think is okay. I'd like a little more shade, I think, in his portrayal. I mean, we're only four episodes if you count Christmas. Mm-hmm. We're only four episodes into, if you count Christmas, a 9-episode run. But I'd like a little more... I mean, obviously, you know, we've established him as, you know, we're no longer a doctor who's angst-ridden because of a time war, and that's all been thrown off, and you know, I had a bi-regeneration, and my miserable side went and lived with some people in a house, And my happy side is now the Doctor in the TARDIS, and I whiz around the universe, you know, singing songs and righting wrongs. That's not going to be fully sustainable for me over time. So I think characters present themselves through adversity, possibly, and obviously, you know, he's had adversity is what he's going through. He's standing on a landmine, but he's still quite upbeat about it. So I don't know.
I get the sense from Gatwa's portrayal that this is an act, and it's a cover for deep pain.
Ooh.
And I see it slip from time to time, and perhaps as this season one continues on, and the Christmas special is Joy to the World,
right?
As they've announced the title, and I just wonder if this sense of joy is more the Doctor trying to put on a brave face. Because if you look at what has transpired with modern Who since 2005, with the Time War, the day of the Doctor, with hiding Gallifrey in a time bubble, and then the Cybermen genocide, which Chibnall perpetrated upon the Gallifreyans, and then the whole foundling storyline, and don't have a mother, oh, my mother's evil, Flux destroying the universe. All of this, I think, is starting to take its toll on the character. At least that's my perception.
Okay.
And this unbridled joy is another mask or an attempt to try to process and deal with it. And I see it. I thought it slipped a couple times here in Boom.
Okay.
Especially when he was talking with Ruby saying, please stay back. I'm all of that.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. I mean, I think, yeah, I buy that. I mean,
we have to see how it develops, but it seems like that joyful mask or that joy slips, and then Gatwa's Doctor's portrayal becomes very serious at times.
Right.
But too early to tell. We're only, what, fourth story into Gatwa's tenure.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there still is time for there to be fully bad things happen.
I think that's going to be in the season finale two-parter,
yeah.
the fully bad stuff.
The fully bad stuff. Because even the toy maker's sibling, which the Doctor feels they have to run away from, was pretty easily conquered. And then we all...
Sibling or child?
Child?
Maestro's the child.
Is it Maestro the child? I thought it was a sibling.
No, I think it's the child because she was talking about daddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they were talking about daddy.
Absolutely, sorry. Yeah. So it's pretty easily dispatched without that much effort. And I think what I liked about Boom is that there was quite a lot of effort expended in getting everyone back safely, apart from dads and boyfriends who didn't get back safely at all. We have the debut of a new companion.
Yeah, before we touch on that.
Oh, sorry.
Since we're talking about getting people back safely, what do you make of Ruby's apparent death? Do you think that was handled well? Was it convincing? As a non-spoilered fan, say, watching back in the early 1970s, if something happened to Joe or Sarah like this, would we have believed they were gone? In the way that Millie Gibson portrayed, for all apparent purposes, death of Ruby.
Maybe. I mean, I don't think we were used to companions dying in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's been established that companions can die. Look at Bill. Look at the finale of season one, where we think Rose's death. I certainly thought Rose had died when instead she got transmogrified to the space station where she was sent. Oh, I can't remember how they went there. Anyway, so that was something that I thought was happening back in 2005. I think that this has been so heavily trailed that there's a bunch of other stuff that Ruby Sunday's going to be doing that obviously she's not dead. She's just fallen over and will get better quite soon. So I wonder at the utility of, she's dead, when actually it might be more dramatic to have something else happen to her other than apparent death. I don't know.
I was thinking how I would handle this differently is why I kind of brought it up. Since this kind of leads into having the new companion, Virata Sethu,
yeah.
in this, if you would have announced that this is the debut of the new companion, and you couldn't have story titles like The Legend of Ruby Sunday, which is the penultimate episode in this. But I suppose if she's a legend, that doesn't mean she has to be alive. You could have hinted on this somehow that maybe Ruby doesn't make it out.
Right.
And we still don't know if she makes it out alive or not. But they kept Virata's debut a secret.
Right.
That was entirely unknown to, I don't think that was spoiled to viewers until they saw it. And even then, it was sort of like, is that who I think it is? And it was.
Right,
so.
Right.
So anyways, it seemed to me like perhaps she wouldn't make it, but you know, you had to go, yeah, she does make it because this is Doctor Who and you know what's coming. You've seen the trailers for Rogue, which is probably the Bridgerton one.
Right, right. Yes, yeah, so you know that she dresses up in a lovely dress and it's aliens during the Regency. I mean, I think where they are, have been, I think, smart is we've got a new companion starting in season two, means that something's going to happen to Ruby. So the implication is that something's going to happen to Ruby. Ruby's living on borrowed time. Ruby's place in the universe will be solved, and that will mean that she won't travel with the Doctor anymore. We know that she's...
one and done.
We're told. we're being told that she's on the way out, which, again, I think is interesting because I think a lot of kind of online, like, they're getting rid of Millie Gibson when she's really good and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, companions don't often last a lot longer than a season. I mean, Martha didn't last longer than a season. Liz Shaw didn't.
You know, four stories.
Exactly. You know, Nardole didn't really last that longer than a season. Bill didn't last longer than a season. I mean, it's only because everyone, not me, thinks Clara is so amazing that we expect companions to just like endlessly trudge around until everyone's so sick of them that they get eaten by a crow.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm entirely in favor of companions coming and going really quickly. And I like that because that, again, talks to something that I find interesting and, you know, enjoyable to think about the Doctor Who mythos, if that's what we're calling it. You know, that the Doctor is, in all intents and purposes, immortal and the companions aren't.
Right.
Which I think that's a good piece of dramatic tension that you can't really explain away. It's always true. And I like that.
Yeah, and I think in this episode, Moffat put that in, that he, the Doctor, is running up against, she has a very short lifespan,
right.
And we got to get moving. That was one of the
right.
things to urge her back into the TARDIS at the end.
Right, right, right.
So that may be a theme that is being amplified in this series.
Yeah, you know, I mean, who knows what Ruby Sunday really is? So, you know, she's not. She doesn't appear to have a next of kin of any kind. Maybe she's one of these things that isn't actually real.
So
that can often happen.
Virata Sethu, what did you make of her as an actor, as a character?
She seems great.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure, given her performance as. I keep calling her Gloria Mundi because that would have been that would have been great.
But
I guess that's a joke too far, even for Stephen Moffat. So, given her performance as Mundi, I couldn't see why she couldn't become a companion right now.
Yeah,
great. I mean, she didn't have anything to her that was like that's not going to work as a companion. She's brave. She's attractive. She has a dead boyfriend. Does she have a dead boyfriend? What happens to her boyfriend?
Well, I think it was a guy who was pining on her, and he's the one
She has a piney boyfriend who she wants to get away from. She's perfect companion material, so I don't know why she has to go away and come back to somebody else if that is what is going to happen, which, of course, it might not.
Well, I think either Moffat or RTD said that Mundi Flynn's story is done. She as Mundi, the actor as Mundi Flynn, isn't coming back. But
all right, not coming back, right.
RTD has a plan that Moffat is not going to divulge, basically.
Okay, right. They're thick as... I mean, I get the impression that those two are actually really enjoying being back together again.
I do too, yeah.
Joking apart, I really do think that they're enjoying getting back together again and being all Doctor Who-y and being in charge of the show, and they've both now been in charge of the show. I mean, I think it was interesting that RTD didn't come back at all during Moffat's run. I think Moffat kind of enjoys being the kind of naughty boy in the team, and I think they're having a lot of fun doing this, which bodes well, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
That interview that Moffat gave when he said that he wasn't writing for this show at all, but then he said boom,
right?
he gave the two titles, it's Joy to the World, boom, you know, and so he's obviously enjoying this.
Yes.
And I think if the showrunner, head writer, and his second in command in some ways as writer, if they're having a laugh doing it, then that bodes well, I think, going forward.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because if they're enjoying it, then their enjoyment will come through in the excellence of the writing.
Yeah. And he'll be back in about 6-7 months worth of time at Christmas. So
at Christmas, yeah, Joy to the World, yeah.
And I think you've never been a big fan of Moffat's Christmas episodes. I think you're more like the spectacle of RTD's Voyage of the Damned type.
Yeah, that seems more Christmassy to me. I'm a lot more kind of it's a big movie at Christmas guy,
right,
than I am it's a ghost story at Christmas guy.
Yeah.
I'd much rather watch The Towering Inferno than, you know, an M.R. James, ooh, it's the Mystery of the Cloisters.
Right.
I like Mysteries of the Cloisters, but, you know, I'd rather sit around with my family and have things explode.
At Christmas.
That's Christmas to mm-hmm. me. But, I mean, you know, as I said, the plots are being hatched, and that's great. You know, if we have a big cliffhanger at the end of this 8-episode run that kind of falls us into, like, a really twisty, interesting Christmas episode come Christmas, more power to it. Looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tradition going back all the way to Peter Purvis, where you cast a actor and then bring him back as a companion. So she steps in a long series of actors, even a doctor actor himself with Colin Baker playing a different character and then coming back.
Yeah,
and
it happens.
It is a small acting community around Doctor Who.
Yeah. So, we'll have to see what she comes back as.
My guess is she'll probably be a woman from the 21st century, as all our companions have been. I mean, this is how many we were millennia. We were like 3,000 years in the future or something like that with Villengard.
That's true. You know, I think that's the RTD thing is, you know, the companion is the character. You know, we learn the story. We understand the story through the eyes of the companion. Therefore, the companion has to be someone who's kind of near to us in terms of, you know, who we are. I actually would like to see a fully alien companion again, like a Nyssa. Bring back Sarah Sun. Why not? style person, like a Leela.
Yeah, well, you get the Rubitron, the dinosaur character that Millie Gibson played.
Oh, yes.
You could have went with that. You know, whoops, you did change it, and now we're going to be...
That would have been amazing if they, like, you thought it was going to be some girl from 20th century. No, it's like an alternative history lizard, Silurian lady.
Right.
That would have been a great twist.
Another twist.
That would have... would end up not working that well, to be honest, but there you go.
Did you watch the Unleashed episode that came along with this?
I did not. My way of watching things is currently broken. So I have not done that. Were you able to do that?
Yeah, I was, and they had both RTD and Moffat entering the TARDIS, and of course they did the line, "I see you've redecorated, don't like it," but with Moffat, of course. Playing that role, but they definitely had that two guys in the pub type thing, and RTD's thing, okay, now we're in the TARDIS, where do you want to go? And RTD's suggestion was back to 2003 before we had any of this. We had careers, we could do things.
We weren't the Doctor Who guys. Funny.
Right, exactly.
Oh, funny.
So I can see Moffat coming in probably, we'll have to see, but I would expect him back in series or season two.
Yeah.
Disney 2.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, he seems to be having a good time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what else he's got going on at the moment. Moffat,
I'm not sure he has much on the hoof right now.
Yeah. So maybe he's just, you know, sitting back, counting his money and writing some Doc 2. I think, you know, I think he knows how much he bit off in a way that wasn't meant he couldn't chew it all.
Right.
When he was, I'm doing Sherlock, I'm doing Doctor Who, it's the 50th anniversary. I think that was a real problem for him. Mm-hmm. And I think he'd probably agree if he was here now. And see, he's probably nodding his head now, Stephen, as he's listening to this. Yeah, Ben's right. I was feeling stressed. Mm-hmm. And if he's, you know, if he's feeling tanned and relaxed, I think that's how we get the best work from it.
Yeah. So hopefully more Moffat stories to come beyond the Christmas special.
Yes. What more do we have on Boom? Where are my notes?
I think it's interesting that they did this all on a soundstage. And it looked like a quarry, but it was on a soundstage. And that's where they could use that LED backdrop and limited cast. We have, you know, the Virata Sethu as a companion, and whether we're doing a Clara or if we're doing a Freema Agyeman or if we're doing a Karen Gillam, or, you know, what link is there? There could be no link. I mean, I find it hard to believe that there wouldn't be a link, but then we as fans always like to try find the links.
We try and make links, but, you know, we have, you know, and I think, didn't we retcon Peter Capaldi being the Roman guy was called? There was some retcon that why Capaldi took that face. I can't remember what it was. Yeah,
that was kind of ham-fisted, to be honest, I think.
Yeah, a lot of bun vending going on there, I think.
What did you think of Murray Gold's music in this one? I thought the mix was down a little bit.
I thought the mix was down, and I was happy that it was down a bit. It was not soaring away in the background and distracting me from what was going on, which I think is, you know, it was a bottle-ish episode. There were relatively few characters, and we were all basically hovering around a character who was standing on a landmine. So to have a lot of kind of swoopy orchestral stuff going on, I think would have been bad.
So
I was pleased to see him throttling it back a little bit.
And this is the director Julianne Robinson's second one after Space Babies, and after kind of the cotton candy taste that Space Babies delivered, I felt this was a lot more substantial, and I was happy, at least for her time in Doctor Who, that Davis gave her the director job for Boom and Space Babies, because if she was just Space Babies alone, I think that would have been...
typecast as the Space Baby director.
Yeah, I don't think that would have been very good. But now here, Boom, it's a very solid episode, solidly written. Moffat touching on themes that he's played with constantly. You know, we like writers who develop themes. He's doing all that.
And I mean, a lot of great practical stuff. I was very impressed by the ambulances, which are obviously, you know, actual machines of some kind, right? I wasn't hallucinating.
They did seem to be three-dimensional props. They weren't just projected on the screen.
They weren't CGI in some kind of way. But they were, you know, they had weight. They moved or trundled along and in a convincing way.
They kind of like the war machines.
Kind of like the war machines. Yeah, I mean, they were... It's funny, we just watched with a young friend of a girl who lives next door, how old is Lo? Can't remember. It's like 7 or 8 years old. Mm-hmm. She came over to watch. She's interested in watching Doctor Who, so she came over and watched the Christmas special. And then we watched half of Space Babies before she had to go next door and have her dinner. Mm-hmm. So having watched Space Babies halfway through for a second time, it's like, wow, okay. The Space Babies, they're basically Daleks. They're little people in kind of things that move around. And when they got all upset about the boogeyman and like started kind of quivering, it's like that's how Daleks quiver when their vision is their vision is impaired.
Yeah.
So the ambulances were also reminding me of Daleks, actually.
Yeah.
We're not going to be seeing Daleks this season, I'm told.
Really?
I'm disappointed. You're elated. But we're still getting things that move around like Daleks, so it's all good.
Well, I kind of think the actor doesn't cement his or herself in the role until he or she squares off against the Daleks. So I think it's a bold move. I guess it speaks highly of your confidence in your lead actor to withhold the Daleks, I guess.
Well, and there is no episode title that is something of the Daleks.
Empire of Death.
Empire of the... Daleks, that's
Empire it. Empire of the Death to the Daleks.
Empire of the Death to the Daleks. I mean, they may turn up. I'd like to see them trundle on as kind of bit parts and then trundle off again. actually.
Pre-credit Daleks.
Yeah, pre-credit. Like those pre-credit Cybermen that Rory dealt with when he was a space Centurion.
Oh, and Good Man Goes to War, yeah.
Yeah, or whatever he was then. I've forgotten what he was at that point. So, yeah, anyway, we'll see. But I was pleased to see that there's still a place in this Doctor Who for, you know, practical things, like things that aren't just CGI things.
Yeah.
And I like that, yeah.
So this was tonally a departure from kind of the high fantasy that we've had pretty much since the special, since Russell's return to the show, where
right.
with the giggle and stuff, this is more, I mean, it's not really hard sci-fi because it's a lot of hand-wavy with AI and viruses and computers and stuff, but it is probably more sciency than The Devil's Cord or The Church on Ruby Road, which was fantasy.
Yeah.
So Davis in The Unleashed said, well, you know, he's basically, the Doctor Who is just a fantasy show, and he's not even going to pretend that there's science involved anymore.
You
can't pretend there's science when you have a time machine. That's just scientifically impossible, and it undermines everything.
Yeah, and he's quite a, what's the word? I was going to say unimaginative, but, you know, that's literally the wrong word. He's quite a kind of doctrinaire sort of person, and he's well aware, as everyone is there's never been any science in Doctor Who. It's not a science fiction show. I can count the science in Doctor Who on the, you know, fingers of one hand, the actual science. And he's completely right. If you start off with a space and time machine that is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, it's a fantasy show. Like, bam, there you go. Does that mean that it's all about goblins? No. And I think that's what I like about the show, is that it is a fantasy show that is not rooted in, you know, Harry Potter, Marvel universe-style fantasy.
Right.
It is rooted in something that's very much its own thing, and that's what's so great about it.
Yeah.
That's my mission statement.
It is a good show to watch on a Sunday or Saturday or Sunday evening.
It is an entertaining piece of... It is a classic piece of televisual entertainment.
I am amused.
I am. Are you not amused? Yes, we are. So yeah, you know, and I think the fact that it can zigzag between babies in space and goblins in the sky and people crawling out pianos to steal music from the Beatles to our main character standing on a landmine for 45 minutes while some space vicars kind of mosey around. That's great, yeah. I mean, I can see maybe one of RTD's, if not brief to other people, certainly brief to himself for this season, is, you know, show everybody what this show can do.
Right.
Show everybody how it can be different from everything else. Now, whether that ends up being successful in terms of BBC ratings, and I guess, you know, we were never going to know what the figures are for Disney Plus, because they're never going to release them. But I'm sure, you know, hopefully the execs at Disney Plus are liking what they're seeing. We've certainly watched it more than once. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that will resonate with audiences and execs in California, Hollywood. I don't know where they live. And, you know, we've already got a season two. We'll get a season three and four.
Yep. We'll see. I don't know if Gatwa's going to be on Beyond Two series, but we will see.
Let's hope he doesn't establish it's the Doctor only survives for two seasons. Three seasons I can live with. Two seasons, there's too many of them now. So I don't know. We'll see.
All right.
But he's a busy man. He's a popular actor. Everybody wants a piece of him. I guess it's up to him whether he's having fun and whether he feels he's doing his best work.
Right.
And that's really just down to him and his agent, I think, at this point.
Yep. We will see. Mm-hmm. All right. Shall we call it a wrap here?
I think it's a wrap. I'm really, we both, myself and my lovely wife, really enjoyed this episode. We enjoyed it a lot more than we enjoyed the previous two episodes. And I've got, you know, hate to have high hopes, but I've got high hopes for next week, which looks like it might be all spooky and set probably in Cornwall or somewhere like that.
Oh, what was
The one where they went to the, what was the one, countryside? No, yeah,
no, yeah, no. I was thinking of the Ben director, his horror.
Oh, Ben Wheatley.
Ben Wheatley's field Yeah, you would know this.
A field in England. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, a field in England. Yeah.
Yeah, they'll go back to Civil War times, take mushrooms, and everything will be in black and white. Yeah, excellent.
There you go.
Looking forward to that.
All right.
I'm the only person who is, but there you go.
All right. On that note, thank you for listening to episode 246 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been thinking of joining the Anglican ministry with Ben.
Oh, and I would be more than happy to walk down the aisle with David as my co-celebrant at an Anglican service in my local church.
Do they use incense and all that?
What?
In Anglican?
God, set you on fire. Well, no, actually, where I was at school, the chaplain, he was very big on incense, so we used to have incense at school, but I think it's kind of frowned on, to be honest, because that's kind of what Catholics do, and like everything the Catholics do, it's kind of frowned on by Anglicans.
Papist.
Henry VIII and all that, you know, set them on fire, chop their heads off, that kind of stuff.
There you go. And on that note.
There you go. And on that note, on that cheery note, no, I really like Moffat's Anglican soldiers. I think they're brilliant.
Yep.
And they can come back as often as they want. I think they're super.
Amen to that.
Amen to that. Farewell. God be with you, my son.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you. There's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Doctor, I think it'll be alright.